Yeah, I have a survey I want to take, I need to take, of the class. And it's not, it won't affect you in any way, it only affects me. The issue is, how many of you purchased new copies of my book from one vendor or another, as opposed to either borrowing a copy or not having a copy or purchasing a used copy? And the reason I need to do that, it's part of a survey over a couple of years, is because I have to pay the equivalent royalties back to the university. So I do not corruptly benefit from the royalties on the book that I assigned you. The university corruptly benefits. But anyway, so if you bought, I first of all, I need to get a count of how many of you there are, so I have a denominator. I get 17 people here, although some I realize are not. Well, let's see. Let me back up. Students, trying to figure out what should be my denominator, I think it will be students who are regularly registered in the course, but the question is non-matriculated students who are registered in the course in one way or another. Please raise your hands. That's almost all of you, but 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. Okay, denominator is 16. Those who have purchased from bookstore or Amazon or the publisher or whatever, from some seller, a new copy of the book. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Do I see? I think that's it. That's pretty good work, actually. You found used copies or you borrowed them. Okay. And I'll use that plus a similar survey taken last year and tote up the numerators and denominators and figure out then from my registrations over the years since the publication of the book approximately how many, how much I have made in royalties and then pay it off to the university. That way they won't be able to come after me. Okay. So, we are... First of all, I should say, for those who have worked on the homework already, are they able to find one or another program that does distance matrix methods? Is that a problem? Is anybody having difficulties with that? I don't see. There are probably more programs for doing distance matrix methods than there are for any other category of the methods in phylogeny work. I want to start in on distance matrix methods, which is a second big category in addition to parsimony. And I told you that Walter Fitch was really the first person to publish these, but Kabbalah Schwartz and Edwards also had them. And those methods were in the category of least squares methods. We're going to come to two other methods that are that don't have a completely defined function of optimality function the way least squares methods do, and those are UPGMA and neighbor joining, and we'll talk about those in a little bit. But what I want to do is start out by saying these methods infer a tree with branch lengths. And there is an implicit statistical model underlying, and we'll be getting to that, although it's not stated explicitly in terms of probabilities of change. You can easily construct one. Here is a tree for 5 taxa, and it has branch lengths, and we'll come back to what these branch lengths actually mean. And what we're going to do is come up with a set of distances between species that this predicts. I'll explain why in a moment. So for example, between species A and species D, if you take the tree with its branchlings and you simply rattle along the branches, you know, driving from A to D or the other way around, and adding up the lengths of the branches as you go, you get a predicted length from a predicted distance between A and D. And here it's 0.08 plus 0.05 was 0.13 plus 0.07 is 0.20. And there is the table in this table of pair of all pairwise distances that you would predict from this tree. There's the entry 0.20 over there and going the other way over here. And so for every pair of tips in that tree, you can do that. You can move along the tree and add up the branch lengths. The tree is implicitly unrooted. There's no particular use of a root here. So, just doing something for safety there. Okay, now what are we really up to? What we're up to is that those predicted distances can be compared with empirical distances that we calculate from the phenotypes of the species. In particular, what we're thinking about here will be molecular sequences. Although there are other cases such as gene frequencies and restriction site patterns that can be also reduced to distances. So we have a tree that's attempting an attempt to come up with a tree of species. And it implies a bunch of two-species trees. So if I were to go in and simply erase species E, C, and B, I'm left with the two-species tree. And the two-species tree that's implied by that tree is the gives you a predicted two-species tree between A and D. So you can think of this tree here as also being a prediction for each pair of species of what the two-species tree would look like if we just had those two species and used our sequences to infer the tree between them. Now what we're going to do is take the empirical sequences and do that for every pair. For every pair, we're going to calculate, well, if those are at the tips of a tree, what's the tree look like? And the answer will be it'll be an unrooted tree, so it will have two tips and just a branch in between them. There's no issue of topologies at all. And that estimate of the total branch length between the two tips from just their data is the observed distance. So we're going to have a set of observed distances from the data and expected distances from the tree. And then the issue will be to try to find that tree which does the best job of fitting the collection of two species trees, which are the observed distances. Now, here comes some algebra. So that's, a warning in case you need to specially cope. Here's a tree with topologies. It's going to be an example that we use with five species, a bunch of branch lengths. We're calling them for silly historical reasons. We're calling it using letter V, and we're subscripting them. So the first five of them are just the ones leading to the tips A, B, C, D, and E. And then there's two interior branches, and we're calling those 6 and 7. Okay, so we have 7 branches. Now, suppose that we can compute from pairs of sequences empirical distances and make a table of those. We're going to come, of course, to how exactly to do that. But let's just say we've done it. And let's say we got these numbers here. Generally speaking, empirical distances are not whole numbers. They have fractional parts. So this is not a great example. So we have a table of empirical distances. We know, for example, empirically, when we infer a tree between A and E, we get 16 as the length of the branch if we just look at those two species. Here is a tree with branch lengths, and here are the predicted distances, the expected distances that we compute from that tree. So we have this table of distances and this table of distances. They're not the same. Here's an 11, here's a 10, here's a 15, here's a 16. Here's a 9, and there's a 10 in the same place. So they differ some. But nevertheless, there's some similarity between these. So the question is, can we come up with a method of comparing those two distance matrices? Now, the thing to realize is we've taken all the information in those sequences and all the patterns we might see. Remember when we talked about parsimony, we tabulated up the sequences, and then each column had a pattern like A, G, A, C, T, and we counted the numbers of patterns, and we had these arguments about consistency. And that's using, under a simple model of evolution, that's using the information fully. Here we're using it less than fully. What we're doing is saying, I take the sequences and grind, get these distances, and then from there on, they're the only thing you use about the sequences. You might look at it and say, well, maybe it's true that once you write down these numbers, that tells you everything relevant about those sequences. And the answer actually is no, it doesn't. I can, for example, come up with two sets of sequences that you would look at and say, those aren't quite the same, that give you exactly the same distance table. That's quite possible. I can also make more elaborate statistical arguments to show that there is more statistical information there beyond these pairwise sequences. Nevertheless, when people think about making trees, if you've never heard of any of our methods, one of the natural ways people would think about it is to say, oh, well, we've got these sequences. Let's look for the two closest ones that are most similar. Let's consider how some measure of how similar they are and use that. So you're sort of led to distance matrix methods reasonably naturally, just as parsimony methods also come up, are not very hard to arrive at. Okay, so what we're going to do for the distance matrix methods is have a measure of the difference between them. Now, this carries us into least squares methods. When we get to UPGMA and neighbor joining, we won't have some of the same structure. We won't have an explicit measure of how similar those two tables are. So what I'm going to do is say, well, let's think about making a measure, I'll call it Q, which simply takes the differences between the observed, that's the capital letter, the observed distance between species I and species J, and the predicted distance between species I and species J, that's the little d, take the difference between them and square it. And furthermore, let's imagine we have some kind of weights, and we'll come back in a moment to where we would get these weights from. So you're not just summing up the squares of the differences between the corresponding elements in the table. You're actually weighting them somehow, which will be done in a way that tries to be more efficient and tries not to get misled by noise. So we're going to have a formula that's just the weighted sums of squares of differences between the two tables. And remember that the two tables, here they are. One of the things they have, they're symmetrical. And there's zeros down the diagonal because you go from A to A in any tree, it's just at zero if you're already there. And this formula looks very complicated. It's partly because this sums only over J's that are not the same as I's. But what would happen if I summed over all I's and all J's? How would that differ from this? A little not obvious. If I included the J's that were the same as I's, I would have some distances here where you're going from DI, the observed distance from D from I to I, and the expected distance from I to I. Those are both going to be zero. That is, any distance measure I make is going to count zero for the distance from something to itself. And any tree I have will predict zero, so it'll just be zero minus zero, so it'll actually add in a term that's zero, so it won't matter. So this is really not that important. We're going to do a little algebra and then leave it aside, but in order to make it simpler, let's take the distance, the predicted distance from I to J, and consider it, it's a sum of branch lengths along a path in the tree. Let's consider there is a funny matrix called Xij, K. Well, what is that? It's just a matrix. Those quantities are just 0 or 1. They're little indicator variables. And all they mean is we'll make it 1 if between I and J, the kth branch is there in the path between I and J. So it's just a bookkeeping device to bookkeep which branches are on the path from I to J. So the D's are just going to be a sum of those branches, V, that have a 1 out here instead of a 0. So that's all that is. It's saying the DIJs they're going to be functions of the branches using this funny matrix, which in statistical terms called the design matrix. So this Q thing then can be written by putting that in place of Dij. That's all that happened here. And then what you can do is say, okay, we want to find the tree topology and a set of branch lengths that will minimize this thing Q. Well, to do that, we're going to have to search among tree topologies. I'm going to disappoint you by telling you that we don't do that in any better way than we do for parsimony. We just go rambling around in tree space. All the same cute tricks and frustrating properties apply. Nothing is exciting there. For each topology, there'll be one of these X matrices that tells you which branch is in which path. And given the topology, can we find a set of branch lengths that minimizes this discrepancy between the Q thing, which is the discrepancy between the predicted matrix and the observed matrix? Well, the answer is actually that we can. If you take this thing and take its derivatives with respect to the V's, to the branch lengths, you get this. And if you look at it, you'll say, oh, it looks terribly complicated. Not actually. It's got a minus 2 out here. And then it's got these WI, it's got summing over all pairs of tips, it's got the W's in there. And then I think I have it's got some of these X's in here, which means if the X is 0, then everything goes. But you're summing up over those. And it's got the D's in here. And then it's got this thing. Well, if you look at it and say, okay, as a function of these branch lengths, what is this? And the answer is it's a linear function. It's a weighted sum of some sort. Because the only place the V's appear is right here in a linear term. And everything else, there's no squares and no logarithms and no nothing. So it is possible by solving, if you could set up those linear equations and solve them, they would solve for the least squares estimate of the branch lengths. You don't have to take the branch lengths and tinker with them. You don't have to take a particular topology and say, oh, okay, let's make this one a little bigger and that one a little smaller. How's that affecting the sum of squares? You could do that, but this is the quicker way. Now, here are what the equations actually look like. So for example, for distances that start at that involve, let's see, this is the derivatives with respect to branch 1 leads you to this equation. And it basically says the distance from A to B plus is from A to C, from A to D, from A to D, all the distances that go through, that start at A, summed up, are equal to this function of this linear combination of the branch lengths. And then there's one for B, and there's one for C, and there's one for D. And then you get to the interior branches. This is the one for branch, I can't remember which. Well, it's for branch 5. You can tell by the coefficient out here. And there's one for branch 6 and there's one for branch 7. And you write those down. Set of linear equations. Well, sets of linear equations you can solve. You can solve it tediously by hand, but you put it in the computer and you can solve it. You can also cast the whole thing into matrix algebra. Again, if you've had matrices, if you have classes involving matrices, this will be familiar. If not, you can try to understand it, or you can just zone out and wait, and it'll go away. Okay. The here, what we do is we set up a vector, which is all the possible distances stacked up, and we happen to have them here in alphabetic order, in lexicographic order, dictionary order. So all the A ones first, then the remaining B ones, and then the remaining C ones or D ones. The design matrix, this X thing, those are all those little x, I, j, comma, k's. And what it says is basically, these are the ones that enter into the distance from the first distance A to B. So for example, the distance A to B had, I have to go back, sorry, and look at the tree. Yeah, from A to B, there were three distances here. I have to double check. I think it's for this one. It's V1, V7, and V2. It's this tree that I'm using as my example, actually. And so V1, V2, and V7 have ones, and everybody else has zero. So all this is a table of which branches appear in the paths for every distance. That's all it is. But it gives you a matrix X, and then you can write down those equations that you got by taking derivatives, and they come out as the transpose of X times the column D equals this thing, X transpose X, which is a matrix times V, times a vector of the unknown branch lengths. And then you look at this and say, could we solve that? And the answer is yeah. You just take the inverse of this matrix and multiply on the left by it, cancels out over on the right side, and you're left with just a V, and over on the left side, you're left with this thing. It's now on the right side, and the V's are on the left side, doesn't matter. So it's the inverse of X transpose X times X transpose D. So you can solve for it, in principle. And in practice. For the weights, we can get them in matrix form by making a matrix that's just got the weights down the diagonal corresponding to each pair of distances. And then it turns out, if you want to minimize not the previous one, I should say, let me go back, I failed to say this. This is the solution for unweighted least squares, where the weights are all one. When you put actual weights in, you get a slightly different formula. It looks like this, and you take the inverse and blah 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 and solve for it, and you get B. Now I'm not asking anybody to memorize those, but just to say that you can do it, and you can do it relatively straightforwardly, and that you can solve these least squares problems by matrix algebra. Is very old machinery and statistics. It goes way back before anybody was messing with phylogenies. Okay, so you can do it. You can imagine searching tree space for each tree, find the optimal branch lengths by all this linear matrix stuff. And then what? Well, evaluate how good the fit is simply by having gotten the branch lengths, you just compute the sum of squares and you see what it's like. And the bigger that is, the worse the tree is. So you want to search, and you now have a number that you can put on each tree after solving for the branch lengths. So there we go. Now you might say, well, why this particular least squares? What does that have to do with it? Why couldn't we use anything else? Why couldn't we use, for example, the sums of the absolute values of the differences? We could use that. It's an okay. It would work. Why not use the sums of the tenth powers of them? Why not use the sums of the absolute values of the differences between the hyperbolic cosines? You could just make up formulas and go on forever. But there is a sort of statistical justification for this. standard statistical least squares approaches would tell you to do this if, and this is a very, very big if, okay, if we said, well, suppose it were roughly true that on a given tree with given branch lengths where you have some expected distances, the true distances deviated from those according to a normal distribution. And this normal distribution for the ijth term had a had an expected variance, the var of, that we'll call var of dij. And suppose this were happening independently for every distance. Then a standard least squares machinery in statistics would tell you to do this. It would say, that's the optimal least squares formula. It takes into account the departures in each distance in a proper way. The squaring comes from the normal distribution. And it corrects for the variances, so the terms that where you expect to have a big variance around the distance get a large var of d down here, which discounts that sum of squares. It says, well, you kind of expect a lot of variance there, so don't freak out too much if you see it. And that is the weight. There was in the formula before, I'd weight w out here, so 1 over the variance is the weight. And you might say, oh, okay, we've got a least squares justification. We've got reasonable justification. The answer is no, not quite. First of all, they aren't exactly normally distributed, but that's a lesser problem. But the more important problem is they aren't really independent of each other. Stochastic random events in evolution in an interior branch can make distances that whose paths cross that branch all get bigger or all get smaller simultaneously. So when you start looking at are they independent, the answer is in phylogeny cases, no, they're not independent. And likewise, I mean, you can come up with variances, you can come up with all that, but they're not independent of each other. So the least squares you're doing here is pretending independence when it isn't quite true. But nevertheless, you can show in a lot of least squares applications in statistics, least squares approaches used to be very big in statistics, they're kind of fading a bit, but they're so useful in some cases where you can do them and not other things. You can show that in such cases, that if you're using the correct expectation, the estimate of the tree you make, even though it's not perfectly efficient, is consistent. That is, if you add enough data and converge on, so the DIJs converge on their expectation, it will turn out that you can show that that the whole estimation is consistent, maybe not perfectly efficient, but consistent. Okay. So this is a little bit of hand-waving about, is there a statistical justification? Yes. Is it really exactly efficient? No. But is it sometimes okay? Yes. Okay. Now I want to talk about where we get the distances from. Okay. So we have a least squares machinery that we can imagine having. And searching among topologies is still a problem, but it's the same old problem. Now, where do we get the distances from? And here I want to go, I start talking about actual models underlying, statistical models underlying the evolutionary process. We're modeling what happens in evolution. We're going to do DNA. We're going to do the simplest possible distance method, the Jukes-Kander method. And it has four bases, and you imagine two sequences aligned with each other. And you imagine yourself changing through time. Imagine a sequence changing through time. And it's not even considered two sequences, just consider one sequence. And what's the model? Well, it's a completely symmetrical model. So it says there is a rate of change, U, we'll call it U here. So that if you've got a site in the sequence that has a C currently, and you want to sort of say, well, what's going to happen under this model? The answer is, there's going to be a constant rate of change, a probability of change in time, in actually continuous time. We're not discretizing in generations. And there's an overall rate of change U. And if you change, you simply go to one of the other three bases at random, with equal probabilities. So the rates of going from C to A is U over 3, from C to G is U over 3, from C to T is U over 3. And that's true of all of them. So it's just the simplest possible four-state symmetrical stochastic process. Stochastic meaning just random. And it's in continuous time, which says that for every little small interval of time of width dt, might be like 0.001 or some very small slice, the probability of a change from C is U times that width of time. It's a kind of process that's similar to what you get if you're making models of, like you're sitting with a telephone waiting for calls to come in, and in every little slice of time, there's the simplest model is every little slice of time, there is a constant chance that a call will come in. And how much? Well, it depends on how small a width of time you take. And so it's what's called the Poisson process. And I always like to point out that somebody once made a similar model for people catching fish. They went out and surveyed how many fish people caught in different amounts of time and fitted this model to them, and they published a paper saying that fishing is a Poisson process. Named after the French mathematician several hundred years ago called Simon de Poisson. Why is that a pun?
Pisces?
Not Pisces, no. I'm not sure it's related. Anybody speaks a little bit of French, yeah.
Poisson means fish.
It means fish in French. But so they went through a lot of trouble just to make a pun. So we have a simple Poisson process, and it goes symmetrically. And then the question is, how do we make a distance calculation out of that? And the answer is, what we need to do is compute the net probability of change. I'm not making a pun with the word net in fish, but that was not unintentional. For any given length of branch, length of time, I want to know what's the probability if I started at a G that I end up at, say, a C. I want to be able to calculate all of those, and in a moment we'll show you that how you make a distance out of that. And the answer is, first we have to get that transition, let's call the transition probability. A little bit of a difficult term. It's the standard term in probability theory. But when we're dealing with DNA sequences, we have the distressing problem that some of these changes are called transitions and others aren't. There's transitions going sideways up here and sideways down here in either direction. And all these other four are called transversions. The probabilities of change of them are called transition probabilities because of a different usage of the word transition, meaning any change of state. So erase your knowledge of which is a transition and which a transversion for the moment, so we can just talk about the transition probabilities, and we really mean all of them. And what I'm going to do is present you with a verbal a slightly indirect argument that doesn't do as much algebra as the direct argument. I'm going to imagine for a moment that instead of having processes that start at a state, and then when they change go to one of the other three, I want to make a fictional kind of event that's a little different. And then I want to try to persuade you that if I do that right, I'll get the same process. Namely, it's a process that when an event occurs, changes the base not to one of the other three, but to one of all four with equal probability. So one quarter of the time it actually changes from that base back to the same base. Okay. Now you may say, well, that's a little different. It wouldn't change as much, would it? And the answer is, well, if I increase the rate of it occurring from UDT for a little slice of time to 4/3 UDT, I can show very easily that it will then give you the same net chain probabilities of change in that little slice of time to the other bases. It'll just add in some that change to the same base, and those you can't see. So I claim that this fictional event with a rate of 4/3 UDT is really going to give you the same process. Now you may say, why bother with that? And the answer is because it's real easy to use. And I'm also going to claim the following. This will require some active intuition. I'm going to say that as you go along through time, if at any point you get one of those events, afterwards you're in one of the four bases with equal probability. And if you go on further and have other events, they won't change that. Once you get randomly assigned to the four, further changes are going to leave you with the with equal probability of being in those four. Now that may take a little intuiting, but I hope you can intuit it, because I can do algebra and prove that to you. Now, that means if there's at least one of these events on a branch, then the net result is just being in one of the four states at random. Okay. Now, suppose these are events in a Poisson process. We're looking at little tiny slices of time. They have a certain average rate for the whole branch. The expected number of events is 4/3 U times the length in time. And it's a Poisson process. Now, some of you will have had, as part of your biology studies, some discussion of the distribution of, for example, the number of bacterial colonies on a plate. And that follows what's called a Poisson distribution, same guy. And it basically is the case where you have a lot of little locations on the plate, and there's a small probability in each one of having a bacterial colony start, and they're independent of each other. Well, here you have a lot of small little time slices in the branch, and whether they have events is independent of each other. So I want to argue that the number of events that occur will be according to a Poisson distribution whose expected number is 4/3 UT. The probability of none of them, that there is no bacterial colony on the plate, that there is no chain, none of these fictional changes at all, turns out in the Poisson distribution to be e to the minus the expected number. And that's e to the minus 4/3 UT. So if you're willing to accept that, which I just said it can be shown that for this, but I can derive it in another 10 minutes. I'm just not going to do it. What you will have with these fictional events is the probability in the branch that there are none of them is this, and the probability that there's at least one of them is that, one minus that quantity. And then you're going to say, okay, so what's the net result? The net result that if there are no events, you don't change. Okay. If there's at least one of these fictional events, you change to a random nucleotide of the four. So what's the probability you end up changing, you started at C, that you end up changing to A? I'm sorry, the other way around. Started at A, you end up changing to C. So what's the probability of getting a C given that you started A? And have rate U and time T. The answer is, it's the probability to get to C, you have to have at least one of these events. And then a quarter of the time you end up at a C. So the probability of having at least one event is this. And if you do, a quarter of the time you end up at C. So there we get, without having to do all the differential equations that you have to do, with a longer form of derivation here. The probability of a particular change in a branch of length u, of length t with a rate u. It's a quarter times 1 minus e to the minus 4 thirds ut. Okay. Now if you say, well, okay, what does that predict about what fraction of sites will differ? Well, there are three outcomes that differ. One is A itself, that doesn't differ. The others are the ones that differ. So it's three times that. So it's 3/4 of 1 minus e to the minus 4 thirds ut. So that's a prediction of the fraction of difference that you get between two sequences with a branch of length t and a rate of change u in the simple Jukes-Cantor process. I said this fictional process, but it's one that you can't distinguish from a Jukes-Cantor because you can't see the changes from A to A. So then you look at it and say, okay, if I see two sequences and they differ by that fraction, I can make an estimate, it turns out to actually be a maximum likelihood estimate, of what the quantity ut is. Ut is the rate of change times the length of time of the branch. So it's the expected number of changes in a branch. So we solve for ut, which you do by just taking logarithms and moving stuff around left to right. You multiply through by 4/3, you put the 4/3 over here, then you move the 4/3 over here, and you move the e thing over there, and then you take logarithms, and you end up with that this thing, which we're going to call the distance, is this formula. So it's minus 3/4 log of 1 minus 4/3 fd. So what does it look like? What does that formula look like? Well, here it is. First, here is the prediction of f sub d, the difference. That's the vertical. The difference is the fraction of differences per site. So differences per site, the fraction of differences per molecule. It can go from 0 under the Jukes-Cantor model. It can go as high as 3/4. It can't go any higher than that in theory, anyway. Because if two sequences evolve and evolve and evolve and get completely different, so they're just, you know, they're not in any way related to each other, they will match by accident 1/4 of the time in this symmetrical model. So they'll be different by 3/4. And what you'll see is this formula, 3/4 times 1 to minus 4/3. I have the letter R here instead of U, but it's the same thing. And what does it look like? It goes up at first when RT or UT is small, when the branch length is small. This thing is almost just UT. It goes up, it's just the rate of change times the time. But after it gets up a little, it starts to fall away from that. Let me ask you, why would it fall below the expected number of changes? Why would you not see quite as many as actually are expected to happen, or as actually happened? Yeah?
So not favorable?
Well, here we have a model that doesn't talk about favorability.
Okay.
It just talks about random change. Now, that could be due to the simplest model for that is that it's selectively neutral change, and these are just mutations.
So it's probably reversions?
It's reversion. Well, that's one of the reasons. And one of the reasons of reversion, that you could change from an A to a C, and if time goes on and you get a second change, some fraction of the time that could change you from C back to A. That's a reversion. Okay. But there's another thing could happen, and that is changes that obscure each other. So you could change from an A to a C, and then later get another change that changes you to a G from the C. Now there have been two changes, but you only see one net change from A to G. So the number of changes you seem to see is less than what actually happened because of changes that overlay each other and changes also that reverse each other. And that's what's going on here. And so you fall away from that diagonal line more and more. As you get out here, here's a numerical point that we'll use. When you get out to a branch of length 0.7945, that says it's long enough that we expect about 8/10 of a change on average. But that doesn't mean it's Poisson distributed. It doesn't mean always no change or one change. It means no change or one change or two changes or three changes or four changes, but mostly none and one. But the average number of changes we expect is 0.7945. Yeah. Okay, branch length is the product of time and rate of change. So if the rate is doubled, that's just like having twice as much time to change. It's a sort of pseudo-time that contains time, but it also contains rate of change. So this allows for the possibility that different branches might even have different rates of change, or different chunks of DNA might have different rates of change. You can adapt this to that. Okay, so there is this plot. It rises up at first nicely, linearly, then it gets low, and finally plateaus at 3/4. If you go out to infinity, it'll just be getting closer and closer to 3/4, never quite reaching it. Okay. So what we can do now is take that and just flip it. That's all I've done here. Just literally. In fact, literally, I made this diagram by taking that one, which was computer plotted, and flipping it, and then relabeling it. Okay. And what it is, it's the same diagram, but horizontally is differences per se. Vertically is this branch length. And so what it says is, if I see 49% branch length here, 49% differences empirically, I can go up here and bounce off the curve, and I shall arrive at the branch length that predicts that 49%. And that's 0.7945. And what formula am I using then? I'm taking the fraction of differences, 1 minus 4/3 times it, take the log, multiply by minus 3/4. Why minus? Well, it came out of the algebra, but it's because this thing is a fraction less than 1. A fraction less than 1, when you take its logarithm, goes negative. So the minus 3/4 gets rid of the negative. And all it does is bounce you back off this curve. Okay. For total statistical optimality, I would have to also show that the fraction of differences is the relevant quantity out of all the other things I could tabulate, as how many cases is there an A and a G, and how many cases is there a C and a C, and how, you know, I could tabulate a table of pairwise differences, pairwise occurrences that had 16 entries, but it turns out that in this simple symmetrical model, the what's called the sufficient statistic, the statistical quantity that you can compute that has all the statistical information in it is the fraction, is just the fraction of differences. And all the issue of whether there are differences for an A and a G or differences for a C and a T is just not, doesn't add anything. Okay, so there's the formula for the Jiggs-Cantor distance. We're at the end, but where we're at, I think what I will do is talk next time about a little issue here of why we do this correction. Why do we use this model and try to figure out what the underlying expected fraction of differences was instead of just taking the empirical fractions? And it'll be because it distorts the tree. And then I'm going to go on to some other variants of least squares, and then I'm going to be showing you these methods in operation. So go thou and do your homeworks and get them in by the end of, not the beginning of, Wednesday. And we'll continue.
Is it Wednesday this week?